Safe in Our World podcast. For those who don't know, the main goal of Safe in Our World is to create and foster worldwide mental health awareness within the video games industry. My name is Rosie, and today I'm joined by Paul Fletcher, who is a professor of psychiatry and a neuroscientist known for advising Ninja Theory in the depiction of mental health within video games, specifically for Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice, and their depiction of psychosis. Paul is also on our clinical advisory board at Safe in Our World. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
I'm very glad to have you. It feels like it's been so long since I first wanted to ask you on the podcast, and we're finally here talking about Hellblade, and I'm very excited about it. So I wanted to ask quickly first, how did you get into consultation of games? It feels like it's such a niche thing that not many people do, and I just wondered how you came about it.
Purely by chance, really. Like a lot of things in my career, it's, you know, completely unplanned. I liked video games, and I'd always had this sneaking feeling that they could do so much in my field, studying thought processes and neuroscience, and perhaps even be used for you know, therapeutic input. But quite by chance, I received an email about 2014 from the commercial manager at Ninja Theory, Dom Matthews, and it just very brief email said, "Look, we're making a game. It's about a Pictish warrior. She has hallucinations, and we want to get it right. Would you mind meeting us and talking to us?" And that was it. That was the start. And I, you know, I was intrigued, and they looked good. You know, their website was very impressive. And I went along and met Dom and Tamim Antoniades, who is the creative director. And immediately I felt I clicked with them. You know, we talked and talked. They told me what they were after. They had a real curiosity and a real desire to be honest, but at the same time to, you know, to make an entertaining and you know, powerful game. And also one thing that got me was they were very keen to have my input at a very early stage. You know, all they had were the rough drawings and the basic ideas. And they were very keen to talk to people who had their own experiences of psychosis or psychotic-like illness. So, you know, that was it for me. And I just saw more and more of them, talked to them more and more. And it grew from there, really, over the course of 3 years until it was released in 2017.
That's so awesome. I didn't realize you were involved for 3 years before it was released. And, like, so I've just started playing it for the first time, and I'm loving it so far. It's quite overwhelming, but in, like, a good way, I guess. And I felt like I was just so surprised, because the first time I opened it up and started playing, your name was the first credit that I ever saw. I was like, oh my god, I know who that is, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was just a surprise to me, actually.
Really?
They gave me a copy of the game, and I knew they were a generous bunch, and I knew that they were very keen to, you know, to acknowledge that the input of everybody. And so seeing my name come up first was a thrill, I must say.
Yeah,
and a surprise.
It's lovely. I mean, and I was like going through your Twitter earlier this week, and I think it's your pinned tweet at the moment, and it's you holding a BAFTA in each hand, and you said something like you've had, oh, what was the phrase you used? Something about champagne, but it made me laugh a lot.
Champagnes to the good.
Several teams champagnes.
Oh, that was quite a night for a neuroscientist, I must say.
And there's also a picture, I think, of you guarding like five of them on the table, which is just, it's amazing, like, how well received it was. And it must have felt amazing for you as well to just be like, this is the first video game consultation you've ever done, and look how well it went.
Yes, I mean, this was a world completely foreign to me. I didn't know what happened when games were released. I didn't know about people streaming them on YouTube. I didn't know, you know, what the whole culture was. I just knew that that I felt very proud of my input and proud of what they'd done and proud of all of the people with lived experience who'd had such a big say in developing it. And I was nervous at first because I thought, well, you know, if this is considered to be, you know, an unpleasant depiction or people see it as harmful, You know, what will that say about me as a psychiatrist? You know, I didn't really feel it would be, but you never know how people will react. And of course, the company themselves were worried about that, but they were also worried about its reception as a game. So when the reviews started coming in, I started to very sort of zealously watch people streaming and see what they were saying and see what the comments were. And it was just so rewarding to see people engaging with it in such a sensitive and mature way. You know, they were really thinking about the story, thinking about the character, thinking about what she was going through. So I was really, you know, enormously pleased and proud at that.
Mm. I mean, I have to say, like, obviously I've only just started, but even like from the get-go, the way that they use like the audio and the settings and everything, it's just like, it's so immersive in the way that you immediately start to understand the character, which I think is probably a huge step with why people were so sensitive towards it when they first started playing.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, because certainly when I played it the first time, I mean, just before it was released, we had a day at the studio where everybody who'd been involved in having an input to the story and the character and the experiences was there, and we watched it from start to finish, and it was a, you know, very powerful experience, just to see it being played, but then to play it myself with the headphones on. And to, I mean, the thing I liked was that it had always been the aim to make Senua a character who is troubled by these experiences, but not one who's defined by them. Or, you know, it wasn't just an attempt to tick the boxes for symptoms of mental illness. It was about a hero trying to battle her way through, which for me is, you know, much more the experience of people with mental illness. It's a, you know, it's a heroic quest every day sometimes to get through the day with dignity and purpose. And I loved that. I loved that about Senua, and I'm glad that people responded to that. And I'm also glad that they, you know, they would. Some people said, you know, after half an hour, I just take the headphones off because I couldn't bear it. And you know, that is that what it's like to be continually plagued by these experiences? Could it really be this bad? And I think that's an important question for people to ask themselves.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, it was quite overwhelming. I didn't play it for, I think I played it for about an hour before I was like, okay, I need a break now. And I think it's important to recognize, like you say, that people with mental illness are not necessarily just their mental illness. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of maybe developers who are starting to think that they want to have mental health representation within their games and within their characters worry about, because they don't want to just draw on the stereotypes and make it all about that, whereas they could instead have a character who happens to have psychosis, who happens to have depression instead.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's got to be a three-dimensional character who's credible and believable, and you won't get that. I mean, you know, it could have been. I think it would have been easy for the game to develop in a very scientific way, where we'd said, okay, we've got the auditory hallucinations, so let's work out what they're like and represent them closely, and then the visual experiences and so forth. But that would have just been a sort of, you know, a rattle bag of unconnected experiences. It had to be connected as a person, and I think that's where the work with the people with the lived experience from, I should mention them, you know, from Recovery College East, which is a group within Cambridge and the area who are really all about examining the process of recovery and their own experiences and doing peer support work and so forth. I think if they hadn't been involved, it would have been a much shallower character.
And so how did you work with them, with people with lived experience, to then implement that within the game?
Well, for me, it was a different experience from normal, because I'm a clinician. And so, you know, usually my experience in psychiatry is in a very professional doctor to patient, doctor to client or service user relationship. But this was very different, because it was a multidisciplinary team who got together. There were people with lived experience, me, you know, the artists and creatives and programmers within Ninja Theory, and it was around a series of roundtable conversations and discussions where the artist would show something that they'd created. People would comment on it, often criticize and say, no, that's not me. That's not how it works for me. And then they'd go away and we'd come back and meet again and discuss things. So it was very, for me, it was very refreshing and nice because it was about talking to people without any therapeutic ideas in mind. It was just, you were asking people, what's it like? What's it like for you? What does it mean to you? And that's a conversation that sometimes gets a bit neglected in the clinical setting.
Do you think that it was quite challenging to create a character that not many other video games have done before, in the sense of the depiction of their mental illness, but also that a lot of people experience mental illness differently to others, and trying to encapsulate that within one character without offending anyone, without making everyone feel, you know, whilst trying to make everyone feel included, but also create an individual. Did you struggle with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a challenge that was recognized very early, and the response to it was to become very modest in ambition and to say, we're not going to create something that's everything to everybody. So why not work with, you know, Tamim had the creative design, you know, the leader on the project. He had a clear vision that Senua was a Pictish warrior who had always, you know, had a troubled background, was a very gifted warrior, had fallen in love and experienced severe acute trauma with the execution of her lover. And I think having fleshed out that as a character, then it wasn't a case of saying, okay, how many symptoms can we stuff into her? You know, it was much more, okay, this, what would it be like for her having this trauma if she had a particularly sensitive disposition, a particular vulnerability to hearing voices and seeing things? But there were lots of other things that could have gone in that didn't, because it wasn't about, you know, it wasn't about a shopping list of symptoms, really.
Yeah, it's not trying to capture every single thing that could possibly. Yeah, it's more about creating a realistic character, which I think is more important, if anything, because nobody is ever going to tick all of the boxes, per se, that you expect from a stereotype of a mental illness. And that's that perception on mental illness as well is quite damaging, because you then have a certain, almost like criteria or standard for certain mental illnesses. And I know that there's like previously in some media, I think people get like a little bit, gatekeeping's not really the right word, but because someone else's experiences differ from their own, they don't see them as the same as like a diagnosis, which I find really interesting. So
yeah, that's a great point. And I do think that to some extent, placing Senua where she was, which was an 8th century Pictish warrior, was in some ways an advantage, because nobody nowadays, nobody playing the game is an 8th century Pictish warrior. You know, there has to be a willing suspension of disbelief. And of course, the other advantage is, of course, that as soon as you pick up the controls, you're tacitly saying, well, for the next hour, you know, I'm going to face the problems with Senua. And, you know, my decisions will be her decisions. So I think all of that came together to make it much easier to empathize, even if it didn't necessarily reflect the precise experiences of any one given person. And I think it's also important to mention, as I said, I don't want to ramble on, but, you know, a very important person in this process was Melina Jurgens, who actually, when I first went along, she was doing a lot of the videoing. She's a video editor and was sort of recording the process. And they had an actor in place to play Senua, and unfortunately she had other commitments that took over. And I think Melina just stood in for a couple of sessions when they were doing some mocap, and it became clear to Tamim, with his great vision, that actually Melina was bringing a huge amount to the part. And Melina herself made no secret of, you know, her own traumas and her own experience with mental health difficulties, and she brought that, and I think she did it incredibly powerfully. So you know, that was a big part of Senua's character, was what Melina brought to it.
Yeah, of course, because you can write a fantastic character, but if you don't have someone to really bring that to life and draw from their own experiences and make it who that is, then it can fall flat sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And it, you know, must have taken a huge amount of courage on her part, partly because Melina, if you meet her, is an extraordinarily modest and diffident character who doesn't push herself to the front at all. So I think, you know, just to be able to scream on command and act that way would have been difficult. But also, you know, I think she had to go to some pretty dark places to play the part.
Yeah, I can imagine. Were you there for any of the, like, obviously I haven't finished the game, but I'm sure there are some, you know, very powerful mocap scenes that are captured. Did you get to be there for any of the filming?
I saw one or two, just, you know, as an experience for me. But, you know, one thing I've learned when I work with very talented people is that a lot of the time I should just shut up and let them be talented, because, you know, I don't have a huge amount to, well, I don't have anything to bring outside my particular area.
I mean, sure, but you're so very humble of a person. Like, you've said about three times already that you don't want to ramble on, but everything that you're saying is so interesting and so valuable.
So that's such a fun podcaster.
What words of advice do you think you would give to developers who are maybe looking to follow in the footsteps of Ninja Theory and create a character like Senua, who is very complex within mental health as well as just a character?
I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, I think artists start with a difficulty, which is that they have their vision of what they want to achieve. And it might seem very limiting to get a dry old scientist or a dry young scientist in to, you know, put borders or limits onto what they're doing and to fact check and things like that. And so my initial advice would be that if you are seeking some sort of expert input, is not to treat them as fact checkers. Actually talk to them about what interests them, you know, what really drives them in their research or in their clinical work, because you'll get a lot of insights. You may get a lot of insights that will inspire you rather than limit you. And I think that's one thing that the Ninja Theory team did with me that made me feel great, was that they were just very interested in my research and they wanted to talk about it. They asked very, very intelligent questions. And I think that allowed them to just highlight the things that they thought they could bring in to the process. And the other thing I would say is, you know, bring people on board early. I think if the more well developed the project, the less likely you are to be able to capitalize on input, because, you know, there'll come a point where you just don't want it anymore. So I think if you're serious about getting an expert scientific or clinical input, it would be as well to do it early, because it can inspire the story. It doesn't just have to be about asking, you know, did I get this right, or would it be okay to say this? I think that's a shame if that's how you limit the interaction.
Yeah, I agree, because from what you've already told me, like, it, you've been involved in everything from the narrative to the sound to the art. Like, there's so many different pieces that play a part within that, and, you know, if you leave it to the last minute to try and get input within that, and there's changes that might need to be happening, including within, like, concept art, within actual character design and within script and things like that, like, that's a lot of work to then have to go back and edit and change.
Yeah.
And probably not possible for a lot of the time. So it's amazing how many different things you're involved with to be able to create a cohesive experience within that, using your clinical expertise.
Yeah, and I would also, this may be heresy to my scientific chums, but you don't have to get the facts right to get the feeling right. You know, I think Tamim is very interesting, because he thinks facts are very important. He thinks that if you do get the details right at a scientific level, that will show. And he may be right, but you know, I quite like science that's wrong. I think science fiction is a wonderful way of exploring ourselves and our ambitions and things like that. And so you don't have to necessarily anchor yourself to absolute facts.
Yeah, I agree, especially if you're in a very, you know, fantasy world already. Yeah. It's not within, like, it's okay to kind of expand on that a little bit, but also, especially with mental health, thinking about it, and with characters, it's so much more complex than just a series of facts and statements.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
With the people, and that's very hard to just write down on paper, you know?
Yes, and I think that gets across pretty much what I would like to say, which is, you know, some of the truest things about psychological processes and mental states that I've ever seen written, and certainly not in psychology textbooks, they're in novels and, you know, films and video games. I think, you know, we should let go of this idea that there is a correct perspective, and then there are the artistic perspectives. You know, I think there are many prisms through which we can look at these complex experiences.
Yeah, I agree. And as long as they're not damaging in a way that's just like drawing on stereotypes and stuff, then 100%, because like you say, everyone's experience is slightly different. And I think the medium of video games are designed to evoke emotion within the player, to empathize with the character that they're role-playing as, I guess.
Yeah, that's very nicely put.
Thank you.
and I think that, you know, video games offer you this extraordinary link between the physical activity and the mental activity of playing it. And I've seen some lovely examples where those two can be brought together or brought into contrast in ways that can have quite powerful effects on the experience. I'm thinking one in particular was a game called What Remains of Edith Finch, which actually won the best game BAFTA the year we were at the BAFTAs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an amazing scene in that where there's a character who, I don't know, have you played the game?
So it's been on my list for so long, and I have it in Steam ready to play.
Right.
I just haven't brought myself to do it yet because I need to be emotionally prepared.
Yeah, no, it's a very powerful game, and it's a series of, if you like, well, this is not meant to belittle it. It's a series of mini games where a young woman has turned up at an old inherited family house, and within each room there is a separate story that she uncovers through game. And there's one very sad one where she comes across her brother's old bedroom, and she opens a letter, which is a letter that the psychiatrist sent to his mother explaining his death. This isn't a spoiler, I hope, but you know, as the letter is being read, it's the psychiatrist's description of his mental turmoil, and it blends into his life in a very boring fish processing plant, with him making these repetitive moves to chop and gullet or gut fish.
Mm-hmm.
But she describes the fantasy world that he came to inhabit at the same time, and you find that your right hand is chopping the fish and your left hand is navigating through this fantasy world, and every so often the two come into sort of synergy where the right hand is doing something that helps the left hand, but every so often they go out where you have to stop what the right hand is doing. And it's this extraordinary sort of sense of dislocation across your hands and across what you're trying to achieve, and it really captures something. You know, it's nothing like schizophrenia that it's trying to represent, or nothing like I've ever come across, but it gets at it at a much deeper level of this sort of sense of tension and dislocation, and I thought it was really powerful.
That sounds quite similar to I recently played Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, I think it's called.
Yeah,
and it's got like a very similar dynamic in the fact that you control one character with one hand and one with the other, or like one side of the controller. And I won't spoil it because I sobbed on stream when I played this game. But it's very strange to combat the usual sort of gameplay mechanics where you would just, you know, control one thing and it does everything normally. Like, you really have to concentrate on what's happening and how you're interacting with each other to be able to make things work, which I think is fascinating as a concept. So, spoiler alert!
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention that, because I haven't actually played it, but very early on in my involvement, I happened to come across a young PhD student called Emma Ray, who was doing a PhD. It's actually in the children's literature department, which was the only place she could get someone to supervise her to do a PhD essentially on video games. Mm-hmm. And she became my sort of guru, recommending me which games to play. And she's, you know, she wrote brilliantly about them. One of the ones she discussed was this Brothers. And she described just what you've done, being utterly, you know, almost heartbroken when one of them dies and all you're left with, you know, you've suddenly got a left hand that's doing nothing. And it's almost a loss or a, you know, bereavement type experience.
Yeah.
Very powerful. I'm annoyed that I haven't played it yet, but
I think you'd really enjoy it because it is, yeah, it is gut-wrenching. Like when it gets to that point and then you're just controlling one, you have to relearn how to play the entire game, which I think is fascinating because it's very interesting reflection of what it can be like to lose someone very close to you, because you have to learn how to do everything by yourself and almost become, you know, too independent. It's a very powerful game.
It's very interesting. I mean, you know, losing someone, there are habitual ways of thinking that suddenly hit blind alleys because that person is no longer there. And you find yourself, you know, just suddenly being cut off and thinking in a normal way.
Or even like muscle memory, where you go to do something and then you realize it's like you've caught yourself. I've been doing that a lot recently. It's obviously like not the same scale, but we've just lost our cat. And every time I hear the door go, I look to let him in, and obviously he's not there. But it felt like very similar in the way that with this, you'd be like, oh, I'll just do, oh, wait, no, I can't because he's not here anymore. That's really sad. And it's like, I don't know. I thought it was really well done.
And it's hard to imagine another medium that could provoke that feeling quite so well.
Yeah, because it's the only like really interactive one that you can get, where you do something and then you react from it rather than seeing someone else.
Yeah.
Because it's just not quite the same, is it?
No. No, interesting.
This is fascinating. I love this. So did you I know that you've talked a little bit about streamers and how they've reacted to Hellblade when they first started playing it, but did you get any I'm sure you did, what was the response from people who maybe do suffer with psychosis? Did anyone play the game and reach out? And
I had a few emails early on which were, you know, very poignant and very positive, where people would say, thank you so much, I can show this to my parent or my brother and just say, you know, this is what it feels like. And I think that's one of the things about stigma and mental illness is, you know, mental illness is often invisible and it's often silent, and it's a sort of internal suffering that separates someone from the experiences of those around them. And that can be deeply both stigmatizing and dislocating. And so I felt incredibly touched that people were saying, well, it's not entirely me, but there are bits of this where I can actually explain to someone that this is the experience I have daily. And then I discovered that the Ninja Theory Studios were getting loads of these emails, which they ended up putting together into a very touching video sequence. Which I still brings a lump to my throat when I watch it. So yeah, you know, the response was just incredible, because as a researcher, you know, my usual output is a scientific paper, which might be read by, you know, three or four people.
Sure it's more than that.
You'd be very surprised. And you think, you know, what is the impact of that really? And, you know, one has to be humble, really, because the impact is often negligible. But this was one thing I was involved in where the overall impact, I think, was very big. And I was, you know, probably one of the most useful things I've ever done in my career.
And do you think, like, that sort of thing is more valuable within being able to teach people about mental illness, or do you think it could be used as a tool? Because I know that we've said it's like obviously not all inclusive of everyone who's experienced it before, but it's, you know, I think it's a very special way to engage someone on how it might feel, in the sense that you've got audio, you're controlling a character, you've got everything around you is immersive in that sort of field. And do you think that could be then used as a way to educate, rather than like when I was at school and I did psychology, it was just very much PowerPoint, 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 which is fine, but it's not how I learn. I mean, how do you think that it would work?
Well, you know, I think it's potentially very valuable. Maybe not so much an imparting fact, because, well, you know, facts are overrated anyway, as we've established. But you know, if you take the notion of stigma and psychosis, the figure I always think of is, you know, somebody on a bus who's responding to voices, and you can see people edge away from them and give them a fairly wide berth and make sure they don't establish any eye contact and all of these things that serve to isolate that person further. And, you know, the obvious question for anyone, I think, should be, what's it like for them? I know what it's like for me. What's it like for them? And when you have assets from, say, Hellblade or other things that you can then play to students and say, you know, you can describe an auditory hallucination, you can define it, and you can quote it, you can quote the voices. But if you just play it in sort of stereo over the speakers in a lecture room and just say, you know, imagine this was your experience when you were sitting in a room on your own, what would that be like? And people respond to that, you know, they respond very empathically, I think. So that's a very powerful teaching tool to get people interested and also for them to start thinking about the nature of the experience. And I use it in my lecturing now, and I know a number of other people have been using clips from the game as well. So I think it is valuable for teaching.
Yeah, I totally agree. I love how this podcast originally we wanted to talk about, because so this is like a really terrible half an hour late introduction, but as part of July, what we're doing is focusing on this trio of exercise, nutrition and sleep within mental health and how they all interlink. And whilst I would love this to be an entirely Hellblade podcast, which it probably could be, I also want to dip into this as well, because we had a really interesting brief discussion the last time we spoke about this specific thing, and I also think it's quite relevant. So with I think, how do I phrase this in a way that makes me sound smart? I want to talk about the concept of planned behavior and impulsive behavior and the way that those two interlink, but also how we can try and change the way that we think and the way that we anticipate goals, specifically to do with exercise, nutrition and sleep, and your kind of thoughts on that.
Sure, yeah, I mean, I it is a really interesting and important subject. I suppose for me a starting point is to sort of step back and imagine just the brain at its simplest, you know, what it's striving to achieve in the world. And I think what it wants to do is use as little energy as possible and be as efficient and rapid as possible. And the best way to do that is not to think, just to respond to stimuli. And I think our brains, or we, are very good at getting into routine behaviors. Behaviors that don't require us to keep working out what the next step is, but we just actually do it. I mean, you mentioned the sort of muscle memory of your cat. I'm sorry to bring that up again, but
no, it's okay.
You know, a noise at the door doesn't have to be processed at a higher level. You just hear the noise, you go to let the cat in or whatever. And I think a surprising amount of our behavior is made up of those little routines, which are energy saving, very efficient, generally unreflective and automatic. And I think we'd probably struggle to survive if we weren't good at that sort of thing. But the problem is, of course, that it does mean that we're slightly at the mercy of doing things as we've always done them, and also at the mercy of the stimuli in our environment. You know, whether that, you know, in relation to, say, nutrition, if the stimulus in front of us is a bag of crisps, you know, we automatically reach for it, or a biscuit, when doing something slightly healthier, peeling a banana or whatever, or having to go out and buy one, is less automatic and so less probable behavior. So I think this, if we have the starting point that we've got all of these wonderful little habits that get us through the day very well, they're routine and efficient and automatic. The question then becomes, well, you know, which ones are actually health promoting or useful for us, and how do we shift our behaviors and change those habits into good ones? And I don't think anyone's got any easy answers to that. But
that was going to be my next question. I was like, how do we shift our behaviors? Because it's difficult. It's not just as simple as, it's like retraining your brain to associate something with something else, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think in relation to things like exercise, nutrition and sleep, which are, you know, there's no magic ingredients towards a healthier life. Exercise, nutrition and sleep are your main ones. And you can take as many supplements as you want, or do as many strange, exercise, or do as many sort of fad diets and things. But basically, getting the basics right in exercise, nutrition, and sleep is the best thing you can do for yourself. And the question is how to break the habits or to set up the new ones. One thing that people have got quite interested by sort of relates to planned behavior. So, you know, planned behavior is, I think it sort of comes in two forms. One is choosing your behavior according to the goals that you really value. And that, unfortunately, doesn't work a lot of the time. So, you know, if your goal is long-term health and well-being, that's a long way in the future. And so it's easier for a more immediate reward to override that and to sort of, usurp your behavior or hijack it. But I think there's another way of planning it, which is perhaps a bit more efficient, which is to identify the points in your day where you engage in the habit that you want to break, and to say, what could I put in place in advance that would help me not to enact that habit? You know, if that habit is eating two packets of salt and vinegar crisps and, you know, getting your daily salt load all in one go, then the obvious plan for that is not to have any crisps in the vicinity. It sounds absolutely mind-numbingly simple, but it really...
No, but it's true, because if that's in your routine, that every week, every time you go shopping, you have this, you get this, you don't think about it, and then it's always there.
Yeah.
So,
it's planned in the sense that you're anticipating the points at which you'll diverge from your goals. And one thing that people talk about is this, I'm not sure if it's a good phrase or not, but they refer to choice architecture, which is, if you like, building your environment to try and push your own choices in a particular direction. So that would include not buying the crisps, because then the choice architecture essentially is that you've removed one choice from the list of options. And another part of that might be ensuring that you have a fruit that you like available. So you're further pushing your choice in a direction that you ultimately wanted to go. Because don't forget that, you know, usually when we get to the point where we actually want to eat, at that point we want to do it now. You know, especially if you're sitting streaming or playing a game, you look up and you think, blimey, I'm starving. And you'll reach for the first thing that's there. So if you can anticipate that and engage in this sort of choice architecture, so that what's nearest to you is something that you might not always want to choose, but because it's there, you've sort of put yourself in a position where I'll have this. And if I'm still hungry, I'll have something else. So yeah, I think that's
stack
sort
the
of,
odds.
Stack the odds, yeah, nicely put, yeah.
I like it. I'm terrible for that as well. Like, I will, especially, I choose not to at the moment. I'm very bad at planning meals, personally. I am someone who does not know what they want to eat until I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very difficult to be able to be like, okay, well, I kind of know like the generic things that I'll have, but and then it'll end up getting to the point where I'm just starving and I will cook whatever it takes the quickest amount of time. And yeah, it is a hard habit to break, especially, you know, if you're living with other people, for example, and you like have to be quick in the kitchen or whatever it is, you know, there's so many factors that get involved with it. And I think it's just about working out what works for you and what motivates you to be able to change habits as well. Because it's tricky. I mean, isn't there like something, oh no, actually no, never mind. I was going to say, was there something about like the amount of times you have to do something to break a habit? But I can't remember if that's right or not, or whether it's just
they did do a study, quite an interesting one that we in a group in Amsterdam are trying to replicate, which is they got people to come up with one thing that they'd like to change about their lives, you know, something very simple but health promoting. And it might be just, you know, always drinking a glass of water first thing in the morning, or always having one piece of fruit for their mid-morning snack or whatever. And they would write this down, and then they would try to enact it, and they'd be in contact with the researchers each day to say whether they'd done it or not, and so forth. And anyway, the long and the short of it was that it took on average 66 days to entrench a new habit.
That was so much longer than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot. My gosh.
I mean, that was the average. Some people were much quicker. Some people were, you know, over 100 days, but the average was 66 days. Whether that will replicate or not, I don't know. But I think it does tell you that, you know, habits, if you can set up a habit, it will serve you well. But it's hard to do it, and it's hard to break old ones. A lot of it is about a sort of pre-commitment to it. I mean, what you don't do, if you want to set up a habit where you're going to go for a brisk walk in the morning, the best way to do that is not to think, well, I'll see what time I wake up, and if there's time, I'll go. The best thing is to say the day before, or at the weekend before, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not even going to consider the options. On this day, this is what I do. And you have everything ready, you know, your shoes and your bottle of water are ready, so that it's just take thought out of the equation. I mean, I'm saying this as though it's easy. It never is.
But it is about
sort of pre-committing and fashioning your environment to stack the odds, as you say.
Yeah, it's hard, because it's almost coming back to like that discussion around motivation. So I have depression, anxiety, and so for a lot of the time I really struggle to motivate myself to do things that I know will make me feel better, but I just don't have the energy to do it. And one of the hard truths, at least for me, that I have had to face with that is that you won't just find it. Like, you maybe have like wake up one day and you feel like you can do it, and you just take advantage of the fact that, you know, it's very opportunistic. But for the most part, it's just forcing yourself to start, and then it gets easier. And it's really hard to do that, but like, it's, for me at least, it seems to be the only way sometimes, is to just literally force myself into doing it.
No, I completely understand that. And I do think, you know, it's very easy for people to pontificate and say, well, you know, it's all about your doing the right things and the motivation. But that would be to ignore the fact that it's very different for everybody. And for some people, a simple act like that is actually enormously challenging because of their frame of mind.
Yeah, like even getting out of bed sometimes for people is difficult. So the thought of getting out of bed and then going outside and then going to the gym and then being in a room full of people that may or may not be judging you for how fast or slow or loud you're breathing or whatever it is, it's daunting. And I think especially thinking how anxiety feeds into that is almost like having these ideas in your head about what it might be like, and then convincing yourself that it's not worth going. And that's why I agree with you in the sense that it's about cutting off the ability to think in a way. It's just being like, I'm not going to allow myself to think about what might happen, because then I'll know I'll convince myself and talk myself out of it. So,
yeah. I know, I do think it's important to set realistic goals as well. I mean, if your goal is to get out of bed, then that's a good goal, because, you know, why set things beyond that if what you need to do is just take small steps to begin with? I think it's very important to, you know, you can't turn it into a sort of a stick to beat yourself with, because then you end up, you know, back at square one or even further back.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's yeah, that's a good point as well, in doing things one step at a time, because it's a lot less daunting to think like, oh, I need to go to the gym, which means I need to do this, 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 and this, and then I'll do this. Instead, it's like, I'll get out of bed. And then once you've done that, it's like, cool, I'll put my shoes on now. And then it's just like one small thing at a time, especially if you're like very easily overwhelmed.
Yeah, and you know, I think valuing the small things is very important. You, to some extent, it is about what you value. And it's important to remember that you don't have to be running 10 miles to be considered to be exercising. Just getting daylight, you know, getting out and getting at least 45 minutes or an hour of daylight, which is enough to sort of set your circadian rhythms, to improve your sleep, to improve your mood. And, you know, I'm not saying it's a panacea, but just having that natural sunlight is... Not that there's, you know, there's a huge amount of it in this country sometimes, but
it's a struggle.
You know, even on a cloudy day, you're getting a health benefit of being in daylight. And I think recognizing that and thinking, okay, I may just be standing in the yard or the garden, but if you can reframe that and say, well, actually, I'm getting a requisite amount of daylight, and that is good for me, I think that helps.
Yeah, the way I used to do it is I would use the walk to the gym as like my ultimate goal, and then when I get to the gym, I'll be like, well, I'm here now, I might as well do something. And then I'll come back and feel great. But it's just like getting there is the hardest part, because then once I'm there, I'm like, oh my god, I've been outside, I've done all this stuff, great, I'm so proud of myself already, and I haven't even done a workout. And that then motivates me to do a workout. But yeah, it's different for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But you know, I think having that way of framing it into achievable goals, and then anything else being a bonus, is a very sensible sort of framing of the whole thing.
Yeah, especially if you're someone who maybe will use any opportunity to put yourself down, which is something I'm unlearning at the moment. It's a lot about language, I think, for me. But, you know, celebrating it rather than beating yourself up for not doing something is so much kinder to yourself.
Yeah, I often think, I was saying this in a podcast recently, you know, there was one thing I could change, it was I'd go for an equal redistribution of self-dislike, because all the people I know who dislike themselves don't deserve it, and I know quite a few people who don't dislike themselves enough and do deserve it, so if we could
they could do with a little bit
around
of...
a bit.
It's true though, a lot of people, you know, could probably do with some more reflection, I guess.
Yeah.
To put it nicely. But
yeah, you put it more nicely than I have.
No, but I had to really think about that. Oh, it's thank you so much for coming on. Honestly, I've had a blast talking to you.
That's great. Talking
about this
to
sort
you.
Of
really
thing.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess before we wrap up, where can people get in touch to find out more about what you're doing, or follow your Twitter account, which I would very much recommend?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, yeah, I've got a Twitter account. Unfortunately, it's got a very unhelpful handle, which is @PaulPCF22. Which when I was setting it up, I didn't realize that would be important, but.
No one ever does. Mine's ArtyParty3, and everyone's like, what does that mean? And I was like, I'm so sorry. It was a high school nickname that stuck, and now I can't change it. So I feel your pain on that.
It was a high school nickname. Was it because you were a more creative type?
No, and this is the thing that makes it worse, is that no one... because it's RT as in my initials, RT. Just because it rhymes with party, and then it stuck. And so I have to always explain it when I'm telling people. It's like, oh, it's Arty Party, but not like RT as in, you know, drawing. And that just makes it so awkward to be able to say in a good way, like quick and snappy. So
kids are brilliant at coming up with very bizarre names, aren't they?
I know. but yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. It's, great to talk to you.
It's been lovely having you. And thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Safe Space. If you're struggling, please know that there is support out there. And if you're looking for somewhere to start, please do visit our website at safeinourworld.org for a list of global helplines, information and support. You can also find us on all of the social medias at Safe in Our World if you'd like to follow the charity in our future endeavours. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.